Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fearless eyes. Temper all the times, the times I
welcome to Court Appointed, Two Dudes' Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer, dude, and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am still just a dude.
We're back in the saddle after a little hiatus.
A big hiatus. I don't know what might have ate us.
We need a little bit of downtime to regroup. So
I guess so. It's a busy summer, and you're a busy person.
I am a busy person. And I don't know what happened. It seemed like once everything kind of opened back up a little bit, everybody decided everybody wanted to sue everybody. And it's been busy.
So business has been good, huh?
And brother, business is a booming. No, it's just everything just kind of stacked up with because all the deadlines got pushed for pretty much everything during the quarantine and when it shut down. And so when all the court systems kind of opened back up and all the deadlines came true again, then it just got a little bit busy.
Well, we're glad to have you back with us. We were on shaky ground there for a while. I didn't know if we were going to get started back up or not.
Yeah. Well, you know, if we take a little break here and there, it's better to take a little break and keep it going than try to rush and put out some product that we're not happy with.
That's right. We got to be happy with the product.
That's right. People got to get what they pay for.
That's right.
Which is nothing. So there you go.
Which is kind of tied into our topic for the day.
Yeah, it is.
Getting what you pay for, where the states have to protect us of what we get, what we pay for when we go to the grocery store.
So our story goes back over 4,000 years.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know it was that old.
It does. And butter has been around for about that long. And it comes from the ancient Greek word of, it's a combo of bos and tauros. Bos meaning cow and tauros meaning cheese. And our butter comes from cows, in case you didn't know that.
It does.
It does. And butter was pretty much the only thing in its kind of area, in its wheelhouse. There was no other kind of butter substitutes or anything really like it until 1869. And that year, there was a French chemist named Hippolyte Megmory, and he was spurred on by a hefty financial prize offered by Napoleon, and they wanted to have a lower priced spread made from beef tallow, which is beef fat. So he invented this and patented it and called it oleomargarine, from the Latin oleum meaning beef fat and the Greek marguerite meaning pearl. And the last was probably because of the color of it, because it had kind of a pearlescent luster. It was kind of whitish. And what the emperor was hoping is that the cheaper butter alternative would help the lower class and also the military. But they actually didn't like it very much.
It didn't taste like butter, huh?
It did not taste like butter. And eventually the patent was sold to Jergens, which was a Dutch butter-making company.
Dutter? That's a Dutch butter combination.
They became part of Unilever, and which is still actually one of the world's major producers of margarine. And the guy who invented margarine actually never really profited from the discovery and died poor in 1880.
Man, that's a sad story.
It is sad. Now, margarine didn't arrive in the United States until the 1870s, so it took a little bit later. And poor people were very happy about it. They were like, this is great. You know, it's cheaper than butter, and it's kind of a nice substitute. And the American dairy farmers, though, as you might suspect, did not like the fact that there was some other kind of butter substitute coming into our country. And so within the next decade, there were 37 different companies in the U.S. who started making margarine and margarine butter. And that pretty much started the butter wars. The butter battles. I actually never saw the butter wars phrase used, but I thought that had a nice ring to it.
Isn't that like the Dr. Seuss book, Butter Side Up, the Butter Side Uppers?
I've never read that one.
And the Butter Side Downers?
I didn't read that one.
Hmm.
So, all right. In 1886, there was a lot of lobbying from the dairy industry, and it led to the Federal Margarine Act, which put a restrictive tax on margarine and demanded that margarine manufacturers pay licensing fees. So they were trying to kind of prohibit it a little bit. Other states like Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Ohio actually banned margarine outright. They just said, you can't have this product here. You can't sell it.
But it was strictly because they felt it was going to hurt their economy because they were butter producers, right?
Exactly. It was just for self-interest for the most part.
Well, that seems to go against the basis of capitalism and fair trade.
Well, everybody wants to be a capitalist till they can get a law passed that helps their business. So
yeah. I can say as a kid, I never knew the difference between butter or margarine. It never occurred to me.
It didn't but, to know, me. Didn't to me either.
Whatever was put on the table that was yellow, square, rectangular shaped, or in a tub, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
That was fine with me. I didn't think anything about it.
Just slap it on my bread and go.
Yeah.
Now, it's funny you said yellow, because that kind of comes into play here in a little bit.
Yeah, I guess because margarine isn't quite as yellow. But that never mattered to me. I didn't care as long as it gave me that same kind of
that same euphoric taste. That same euphoric feeling.
Yeah, that's right. Roll your corn on the cob in it or whatever.
People that were opposed to margarine, they said that margarine threatened the family farm, the American way of life, and moral order. So they were
moral order?
Yeah, they were saying this margarine is going to be the downfall of our society.
Oh my God. Hey, now you're getting carried away.
The speeches that these politicians made, they were constantly in defense of the sweet and wholesome butter. There was one governor, Lucius Hubbard of Minnesota, and he said that the ingenuity of depraved human genius has culminated in the production of oleomargarine and its kindred abominations.
Margarine is an abomination, huh?
There's a senator, Joseph Quarles of Wisconsin, and said that butter should come from the dairy, not the slaughterhouse. He said, I want butter that has the natural aroma of life and health. I decline to accept as a substitute cow fat matured under the chill of death, blended with vegetable oils and flavored by chemical tricks.
And besides that, have you seen the size of the checks the butter people are sending me?
Well, I think he was from Wisconsin, so I don't necessarily think he was actually getting checks. He was probably just representing his constituents.
Yeah, they're trying to keep a monopoly on the butter business.
So, as you had mentioned, butter is traditionally it's yellow, and that is derived from the plant keratin of the milk of the grass-fed cows. Margarine, which is made in vats, is white, hence the name where it had the pearl. And so margarine manufacturers, wanting to appeal to the public more, started to tint their product yellow.
I see nothing wrong with that. There's a lot of products that appear a different color than what they really are just because the people think that's more appealing to the general public.
That's true. But as you might imagine, the butter manufacturers were livid, and they said that yellow margarine, fraudulently masquerading as butter, was a deliberate ploy to deceive the public.
Let the public decide. They don't have to have somebody, the government, decide that for them.
Well, the funny thing is, though, is that, as I mentioned, grass-fed butter is more yellow, but corn-fed cows, that usually results in a more pale-type butter color, and that actually is dyed by butter producers. Mm. But they said that was just a bit of a cosmetic tweak. They weren't trying to deceive anybody. It was still butter.
So. Well, that seems weird. The green grass gives you yellow butter, but the yellow corn gives you white butter.
Yeah. So that brings us to 1902.
And it all passes through the cow, so that means it's utter nonsense.
Utter nonsense. By 1902, 32 states had imposed color constraints on margarine. Vermont, New Hampshire, and South Dakota all passed laws that margarine be dyed an off-putting pink. So they actually said that you have to dye margarine pink to make it different. Other states said that proposed that it could be red, brown, or black. And eventually, these laws were overturned by the Supreme Court.
So butter laws went to the Supreme Court?
They did.
Oh, my gosh.
So the Supreme Court said that, you know, you can't force them to dye it these certain colors. But the ban on the yellow margarine actually remained. And Wisconsin was the last to repeal its margarine color law, and that was in 1967. Now, margarine and butter have kind of had this weird up-and-down relationship. So, during the Depression, and when butter were in shortages during the World Wars and things like that, margarine actually started to bypass butter as being more popular because it was cheaper and it was available.
Yeah.
Whereas when there weren't times of crisis, it would seem that butter actually would outsell margarine. So, there's kind of always been just a natural ebb and flow based on the economy and the cost and things like that. By the 1970s, Americans were eating about 10 pounds of margarine per person per year, it said.
10 pounds per person per year?
Yeah. And Eleanor Roosevelt said that she ate margarine on her toast, and that was kind of a big thing, you know, because if the First Lady has margarine on her toast, then it must be good.
Sure.
Now, one interesting thing happened in 1955. Wisconsin, which seems to be the hotbed of all this dairy ruckus...
Of butter ruckus.
There was a senatorial taste test in 1955, which senators, blindfolded, were challenged to tell the difference between butter and margarine. And these were all Wisconsin-born and bred senators. And most of them weren't fooled, except there was one person, Gordon Roselip, who preferred the margarine, insisting that it was butter. And here's the funny thing. It turned out later that Roselip's wife, who had been worried about her husband's heart and all the butter he had been eating, had for years been substituting margarine, yellow margarine, for butter at the dinner table. So he actually thought he had grown accustomed to it and thought that the margarine was actually butter because his wife had been dosing him with it.
That's the way it should be. I mean, you should be able to decide for your own taste and pocketbook.
Yeah. And it was funny, the different laws they passed that you said you can't sell yellow margarine. Margarine producers would sell their margarine just white or in its normal color, and they would give color packets back in the day. And you would take these color packets and pop them essentially into your margarine, then mix it around before cubing it out into blocks. So it would actually give it that normal color. But they couldn't sell it like that, but they would give you all the different pieces you need to make it look normal.
So if you were tricking your husband into believing it was butter and wanted to make it look yellow, huh?
Yeah, which is exactly...
Just like that other senator.
Yeah, which is exactly what Mrs. Roselip evidently did. And now it seems like that butter has kind of surpassed margarine again, and people in the United States are eating 5.6 pounds of butter a year, and margarine's down to 3.5 pounds. And there's been a lot
that seems low.
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of evidence that shows that the trans fats in margarine could actually be worse for you healthy wise, whereas the saturated fats in butter are not as bad as people originally thought. And, you know, in moderation, they can actually be good for you. So,
well, you know, one of the things I think, though, is proliferating the resurgence of butter as well is all these cooking shows and cooking competitions and all this kind of stuff, because in that they will tell you the advantage to cooking with real butter in your whatever it is you're making as opposed to margarine or whatever.
Yeah. You know, it was funny in 2002, and this is after the last color ban for margarine had been lifted. Parquet, who's one of the major producers of margarine, they introduced a fun squeeze bottle, and it came in two different colors, and one of them was pink. It came full circle. They didn't have to dye it pink at this point, but they opted to do it because it was fun.
I do remember, I mean, that margarine, when it had to be more white, and that's how you could tell, but I never really cared. It wasn't on there long enough before it was inside of me to matter whether it was butter or margarine.
Yeah. I will say, as I've gotten older, I have been able to develop a taste, and I do prefer actual real butter as opposed to margarine.
I would say I'd be hard pressed to determine the difference.
Well, maybe Mary's been dosing you with margarine this whole time in order to keep you healthy.
Well, I think up until recent time, we have only ever had margarine. Yeah. I mean, from what I can remember being in the refrigerator, we usually did have margarine, and then only time she would get butter is if she was going to make some kind of special cake or something like that where, you know, it called for butter and you use that instead of margarine, because they don't always react the same when making a recipe because of, I guess, the difference in oil and milk or whatever.
Yeah. Well, and also when you're baking, you're doing kind of a chemistry experiment, so you have to have exactly right. All the different chemical things that happen have to occur.
Yeah. Yeah, and it would specify butter, not margarine, so you'd have to have it for that. But I think other than that, we always had margarine on hand.
Well, all these laws appear to be utter nonsense, if you ask me.
That's right.
Stealing your joke again. We've got some different talks to go on about Wisconsin laws and other things about butter and cheese and all good things dairy. But before that, I think there is a motion before the court.
Why, yes, if it pleases your cheese ship, we'd like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
All right, who's on the docket? Turn away.
Turn it. Our good friends at Care Of.
Care Of is a wellness brand that makes it easy to maintain your health goals with a customized vitamin plan that helps you feel your best today and supports you long term.
It's hassle-free vitamins and supplements delivered to you.
Care Of can make taking your vitamins and supporting your health goals attainable.
Care Of's easy online quiz helps you find the vitamins and powders that will support your specific health goals, like improving your fitness routine or managing stress.
And there's quality that you can see and taste.
Care Of is focused on the quality, science, and research that goes into each of their products and recommendations.
And their yummy protein powders are made of wholesome ingredients you can recognize, like organic cocoa and pink Himalayan sea salt.
Now, this is health made easy thanks to Care Of's online quiz. We've each taken this short online quiz, and you just answer some questions about your diet and health goals and lifestyles, and Care Of will recommend a list of vitamins and supplements specifically for your health needs and goals.
The vitamin aisle can be very confusing. It's hard to know where you need to start and what you need to get, and what is it even for?
Answer easy questions like, how much sleep do you get? How often do you work out? Do you follow any specialty diets? And are you concerned about your hair, skin, and nail health? And more.
Just follow Care Of's expert recommendations or adjust your pack at any time. And what you receive is totally up to you.
So, here's what we do. For 50% off your first Care Of order, go to careof.com and enter the code COURT50.
That's right. So for 50% off your first Care Of order, go to takecareof.com and enter the code COURT50.
And receive your 50% off introductory offer.
And enjoy taking the quiz, because it's actually kind of fun, if you like quizzes.
And everybody passes this quiz. No, there are no failings.
No, there are no failings in this quiz. It's a win-win situation.
So take Care Of.
So Wisconsin actually still has laws on the books which ban margarine. So they're still kind of keeping margarine off the table. And the sale of margarine was just outright banned from 1895 to 1967. But now there are, and they did remove some of these. And in 2011, there was an effort to remove most of them, but they were actually defeated. And the most notorious of all the margarine-related laws, which is still in effect, is Wisconsin Statute 97.18. And subsection 4 of that says that it is illegal for a restaurant to serve margarine as a butter substitute unless it is specifically ordered by the customer. So it says, the serving of colored oleomargarine or margarine at a public eating place as a substitute for table butter is prohibited unless it is ordered by the customer. And then later on down section 5, it says it forbids margarine to be served to school children, prisoners, and hospital patients unless there's a doctor's order that the person must have margarine. It says The serving of oleomargarine or margarine to students, patients, or inmates of any state institution as a substitute for table butter is prohibited, except that such substitution may be ordered by the institution superintendent when necessary for the health of a specific patient or inmate, if directed by the physician in charge of the patient or inmate.
And it even says that it has penalties up to 3 months in jail for a first offense and a year for a second.
Yeah, and fines. So,
can you just see if you're in prison and the guy next to you is like, what are you in for? Well, I served margarine.
And you're in Wisconsin, you're like, you dirty dog. You dirty dog. Yeah. You had it coming.
That's right. The guy's in there, you bastard. You're going to pay in here. you non-butter bastard. Well, you know, in Wisconsin, they evidently, they're pretty strict with their food laws because they also want to protect their cheese.
Yeah, it's all dairy up there.
Yeah, so they have some really strict things concerning their cheese. According to laws that were put in effect in 1993, Wisconsin cheddar must be highly pleasing, while Brick and Munster must be free from sweet holes, but can have a very slight feed flavor. And Baby Swiss requires well-developed eyes. The flavor of Colby and Monterey Jack must be both fine and highly pleasing, but is allowed to be lacking in flavor development. In bandage cheeses, the bandage shall not be wrinkled, burst, or torn, and the cheese shall not be lopsided or huffing. All flavors.
I hate a huffy cheese.
I know. All flavors and tastes must be determined organoleptically. I don't know what organoleptically is. I'll have to ask Sydney about that. Foods beside butter and cheese are eaten in Wisconsin pursuant to statutes passed in 2007. This is where in 2007 they defined what a meal is. So if a meal is used in a legal term, and it says a meal is a diversified selection of food products that are customarily consumed as breakfast, lunch, and dinner and cannot be easily eaten without accompanying tableware and may not be conveniently consumed while standing or walking. A sandwich is a food that consists of a filling that is placed between the slices of bread pursuant to a 2009 law, and the sale of fish flour is allowed with appropriate labeling. So they felt the need to define what a meal is and what a sandwich is.
Well, that's because that's your way around. You know, if you have this law which talks about cheese and whatnot, and you say you can't serve any of these in a meal, but then you don't define what meal is, then that's your loophole to get around it. So you have to make sure you have everything properly defined in all your different codes and ordinances and statutes to make sure that there's no loopholes. Got to have that tight law.
I can say I've never thought that hard about how to define what a meal is.
Well, nobody's ever paid you a lawyer's hourly rate to figure out, to think that hard about it.
Would that make me think up those things?
It would. When somebody's paying you a nice hourly rate to win their argument for them, you come up with lots of good arguments. Now, there also is some butter grading law, which Wisconsin has. So,
yeah,
Wisconsin has laws which says that every butter that is sold inside the state has to be graded by the USDA. And it has all these different kinds of terms and phrases and whatnot, kind of like how you were talking about the cheeses. And to me, it pretty much seems like a bunch of nonsense words. They have to have, there's four different grades. AA must have fine and highly pleasing butter flavor. Grade A must have pleasing and desirable butter flavor. Grade B must have fairly pleasing butter flavor. And there's undergrade butter, which is fails to meet the requirements for Wisconsin grade B. So that means it's not
fairly pleasing.
It's not fairly pleasing, I guess. And so in order to achieve these different grading systems, you actually have to pay somebody to come in and
a professional butter taster?
Professional butter taster or grader, and then put these different labels on it if you want to sell it in Wisconsin. Now, for butter that's sold in Wisconsin, it's not a problem because they have their own local inspectors that come in and do it in state. But there's one dairy, and this is Minerva Dairy, which is in Ohio, and they make Amish-style butters, which are slow-churned, and they use fresh milk supplied by pasture-raised cows to make slow-churn butter. And they've sold their artisanal butters to consumers in every state, and they were selling it in Wisconsin as well, until...
One of these butter laws got them?
Until, in 2017, Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture had received an anonymous complaint that this Minerva dairy butter was being sold in Wisconsin and had not had its butter graded by a Wisconsin-licensed butter grader.
Oh,
and,
no.
Yes. And allegedly, Minerva Dairy is one of the oldest dairies in the country. And you can imagine that if it's Amish and they're slow-churning it, that it's probably pretty safe to say that it would meet the highest grade of a fine and highly pleasing butter flavor, I can only assume. But I'm not a professional butter grader. I've never tried it, so I don't know for certain.
I wouldn't know the difference between fine butter and fairly good butter.
Yeah. So they filed a lawsuit and went to court and said that by forcing them to have a Wisconsin certified butter grader,
butter taster,
that it violated the Commerce Clause, the Equal Protection Clause, and the Due Process Clause, because at this point it's affecting interstate commerce, which we've talked about before. And so if you're a Ohio dairy and you want to sell your butter in Wisconsin and there's some sort of state law which effectively makes it so you can't sell your butter there, then that would violate the Commerce Clause because it's affecting interstate commerce. And states aren't allowed to pass laws which are on their face
restrictive to other states.
To other states, yeah, exactly. So they filed a lawsuit, and they actually lost. The court ruled that these laws were okay and that they were valid and constitutional, and it didn't violate the Constitution of the United States. And so, being a disgruntled dairy farm that they were, they filed an appeal, which went to the Seventh Circuit. And the Seventh Circuit in Chicago actually upheld and said that Wisconsin's law does not discriminate against out-of-state butter producers. So, I mean, on its face to me, it seems like it has to, but obviously...
Well, I guess they could always ask.
Smarter minds than me said it didn't.
Yeah, well, they could always ask, I guess, just to have somebody from there grade it or what something. It just says it has to be graded. It's not like it says you can't.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, too, is that then if they sell it, then they have to change their packaging just for that one state because their packaging doesn't normally have the grading that the rest of...
Well, it's true.
So it makes it... There's an added cost to it as well. So, but, you know, it's not much different than if a certain state has different alcohol laws that says that, you know, beer has to have, can only be a certain percentage, or it has to have certain disclosures on it, or things like that. If you want to sell in that state, then you actually have to meet those labeling requirements.
Yeah, I guess so. That does seem pretty petty, though. You should be able to buy whatever you want to buy if it's a legal product.
Yeah.
I mean, let's travel out of state and go pick up some Amish butter.
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it, all these restrictive dairy laws, they've created a real monster.
See what you did there. Monster.
This is an argument I would have liked to have made in court. I could have poked more holes in it than the Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
I'm running out of dairy puns.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you are. Your jokes are getting cheesy.
Well, mine may be getting cheesy, but yours always are, so.
Yeah, well, at least they're not margarine-y.
Oh. So when I was researching all the different Wisconsin food laws, I decided to kind of figure out what other strange states and food laws there might be out there. And I came across one that I thought might be particular interest to you, Tommy.
Oh, yeah?
So... You've heard of Clint Eastwood, correct?
Oh, absolutely. He's my hero.
Well, you know, he was once the mayor of Carmel by the Sea in California.
Correct. Uh-huh.
He was the mayor there from 1986 to 1988.
Yeah.
And his campaign slogan was, "Bringing the community together." which I think sets a pretty good slogan.
Sure.
And before he became mayor, there was a strange law in the books that prohibited selling and eating ice cream on public streets in the city. So the repeal of this law became one of the pro-business focuses that Eastwood's campaign was for at that point. And he stressed his desire to build bridges between the business community and the residential community, and he wanted to overturn the ban on ice cream.
Well, I would be in agreement with that.
He said, the city's refusal to grant a permit for an ice cream stand last year, deciding that it would consume too much water in the time of drought, focused worldwide attention on the tiny tourist town. He campaigned that the promise to do away with the old city hierarchy's killjoy mentality in such matters. And he said he fondly remembered eating ice cream on Carmel Street corners as a youth and would support the licensing of new ice cream stands in the city. And he said, I hope to never read about ice cream cones again, he said, after the law was overturned. So that was one really strange law that was on the books, is they were not going to allow ice cream stands in Carmel by the Sea. And Clint Eastwood evidently made that a part of his platform that he ran to become mayor. So I think as a politician that being pro ice cream is a pretty genius move. I mean, who doesn't love ice cream?
That's right. That's like being pro baby or something, you know? I mean, who would be anti baby?
Who would be? I don't know.
I mean, not eating them like ice cream, but you know what I mean.
Anyway, I thought that was a strange food law, and I thought you would enjoy that, given your love for Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, well, he cleaned that town up, too.
He did. And it's kind of funny if you think about it. If the town's called Carmel by the Sea, and there's no ice cream stands allowed. Carmel.
Yeah. Carmel.
Yeah.
No Carmel Sundays. Well, since we're branching into other ones, I found a few other strange ones that I thought were interesting, too. Now in Singapore, they did not, the import of and sale of gum had been banned since 1992. A guy named Lee Kun Yew, father of the country, recounts in his memoirs, ministers who had studied in America recounted how the underside of lecture theater seats were filthy with chewing gum stuck to them like barnacles. So they just banned gum in Singapore altogether. And President Clinton and former U.S. Congressman and lobbyist Phil Crane finally achieved a partial lifting of the ban as part of a free trade agreement so that gum companies like Wrigley's could open a new market. Now, gum can be sold, but only for medicinal or therapeutic purposes, an exception conveniently leaving room for gum like Wrigley's Orbit with calcium lactate to strengthen enamel. The gum can be sold only by dentists and pharmacists, with all sales registered and names taken. Smuggling gum into the country carries a 1-year jail sentence.
Wow. Why didn't that... Wasn't there some American that got caned in Singapore for chewing gum or something at some point?
No, I don't know about that. I remember there were somewhere that got caned a while back for different things, but I don't remember what it was for. Oh. But there is a reference in the movie Legally Blonde. Mm-hmm. There is a reference to that about chewing gum in Singapore.
Really?
Yeah.
I've actually never seen that movie.
You've never seen Legally Blonde?
I have not.
Now, it seems that in the European Union, they had particularly tough laws concerning vegetables. In July 2009, the European Union bureaucrats yielded to public pressure and repealed detailed statutes concerning the shape, size, and color of asparagus, which it had to be green for 80% of its length, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, and 23 other fruits and vegetables. The laws exasperated both the buyers and the sellers, and England's Sainsbury's market chain withdrew a Halloween promotion featuring imperfect fruits and vegetables for fear produce managers would be arrested as criminals, and then fought back with a Save Our Ugly Fruit and Vegetables campaign. This marked a new dawn for the curvy cucumber and the knobby carrot, said the European Commissioner of Agriculture, speaking of the demise of the laws. It said that pursuant to the law, Class 1 cucumbers had to be well-shaped and straight. Maximum height of the arc, 10 millimeters per 10 centimeters of the length of the cucumber. Gherkins were exempted.
the repeal does not extend to bananas, which must still be free from abnormal curvature, though Class 1 bananas can have slight defects of shape, as an EU spokesperson grudgingly conceded a curve is a normal shape for a banana. This wasn't the first food fight in EU's contentious history. Greece quarreled with Denmark when the Danes tried to sell feta cheese, and the Danes successfully resisted an EU ban of their beloved Queen Bridget apple, deemed too small for Eurocrat palates. Similar skirmishes have erupted over Gouda and sherry. EU chocolate has been especially controversial. Traditionally made with cocoa butter, England successfully demanded that cheaper vegetable fat be allowed as a substitute, and a 2000 chocolate directive for the first time allowed England to export the cheaper chocolate to other EU members. Parisians were appalled as Mars bars and Kit Kats flooded the city in place of their beloved Carillo, its delicate yet complex rich secondary notes, and Gyanju, nutty, slightly gritty, and protested by picketing EU headquarters in Brussels. Godiva sniffed that only chocolate with cocoa butter should be considered real chocolate, while the more commercial Cadbury urged chocolate snobs to lighten up and celebrate Europe's diversity. So the two different kinds of chocolate there, you see, are really kind of similar to butter.
Yeah, well, it's funny, too, because if you think about it, it's essentially kind of the states' rights versus the federal government's rights is the same thing to the different European governments versus the EU's rights. So it's very similar at the melding of all that and the way it works out, because each country has its own traditions and kind of each state has its own traditions as well. So it's hard to kind of come together and figure all this out. But
now we do have in the U.S., the U.S. Department of Agriculture has authorized commercial item descriptions to help ensure that hardworking government employees get the correct condiments that they deserve. So for their protection, there is a list of 7 official ketchup flavors for government employees, although jalapeno is divided into 3 subcategories. And the government-approved smooth texture does not take into account any stray bits of onions, although on taste, there can be no compromise. So here's your 7 classifications. Garlic, habanero, mesquite, smoke, jalapeno, which is divided into mild, medium, and hot, and then chipotle and other. So other seems kind of like it can be anything, but they have it that way.
This ketchup that's defined as other tastes and looks like mustard. You know.
Well, funny you should mention mustard. On the other side of the condiment scale, as of May 29th, 2007, the mustard metric AA20036C supersedes mustard metric AA20036B and yellow spicy brown Dijon mustard, stone ground horseradish, deli, and other mustard may now be served to hungry government bureaucrats throughout the land. Yellow shall be of smooth consistency and mild flavored. Dijon must hit mild white wine notes, and horseradish shall have visible specks and a pungent, hot, and spicy flavor. Testing and laboratory analysis of all officially approved mustard flavors shall be done in accordance with the official methods of analysis of the AOAC International. What do you think about that?
It's that's some spicy laws.
Well, I can't believe that they have, and it specifies it's for government employees. So I guess that's any contract that they enter into to supply condiments for government offices have to meet those standards.
Yeah, well, I know government contracts, they have very strict specifications about everything. So why stop with ketchup? Keep it going.
Now, the last one I have kind of explains a long-running controversy, the tomato. Fruit or vegetable?
I'd say it's a vegetable, although it does have seeds, but I think it's a vegetable.
Well, here this dates back to a Supreme Court case of Nix.
Here's probably why I think that. Tomatoes are grown in a vegetable garden. That's just my thought process.
Is that what you think?
That's what I think.
All right, the Supreme Court case of Nix v. Hedden, 1893, held that tomatoes are a vegetable, not a fruit, based on a carefully reasoned analysis of their rightful place in soups, desserts, as well as companion to fish and meats. The case arose from a disputed interpretation of the Tariff Act of 1883, which required that tax be paid on imported vegetables, but not on fruit. Nix claimed that tomatoes were a fruit and therefore not taxable. They are, scientifically, tomatoes are considered a fruit. But tax collector Hedden claimed that tomatoes were a vegetable. At trial, the Nix attorney read the definition of fruit and vegetable from three different dictionaries, and his two expert witnesses discussed the implications of cabbage, cauliflower, turnips, potatoes, peas, and beans. Hedden's attorney countered by reading his own definitions of peas, eggplant, cucumber, squash, and peppers, with Nix's attorney then responding with yet more definitions, this time of parsnips and carrots. The Supreme Court decided in favor of the tax collector, finding that the tomato's use in savory meals made it a vegetable, not a fruit, and declaring that tomatoes are usually served at dinner in, with, or after the soup, fish, or meats, which constitute the principal part of the repast, and not like fruits generally as a dessert. In 2005, New Jersey cited the Nix case along with tomatoes' legendary flavor as a basis for designating the tomato the official state vegetable of New Jersey.
I didn't know. I didn't know New Jersey had such a long, storied history with tomatoes to make it their state vegetable.
Yeah, but I mean, it is technically, scientifically, it's a fruit, but for tax reasons, it's been declared a vegetable because you eat it with the meal, not as part of the dessert, which fruits are generally eaten as. So that's what it came down to. And the Supreme Court had to make that decision.
I don't know. I see it as a vegetable. I'm just saying. I agree.
Well, it, like I say, scientifically, it meets the designs of a fruit.
Well, we all know you can't trust science.
No, you can't. That's why, even though they tell you to wear a mask to quit spreading it around, we don't have to listen to that.
Nah. Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs. That was better.
Yeah. Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we ask Tommy different legal questions and see if he remembers what we talked about. Now, this one's going to have a very specific, singular type question.
Okay.
And let's go see what this is going to be. Kind of a we're going to call this a midterm or a final, because it's covering things that maybe weren't presented in the episode today, but we've talked about in the past.
Well, hell, with as long as it's been since our last episode, I'm having to remember months back.
So, what was one of the main grounds that the Wisconsin butter grading law was challenged by? The Ohio Dairy Farm.
The Interstate Commerce Clause.
That's right. And what is the Interstate Commerce Clause, and how does it apply to this instance?
Well, it was restricting trade between the states, which you're not allowed to interrupt that. And the government has a final say. The federal government has a final say in anything that disrupts the flow of commercial matters between the states.
And the court in this case said that it did not violate the Commerce Clause, and they said that it, they reviewed it. Do you remember the review, the standard for it, for the Commerce Clause?
The standard for the Commerce Clause?
Yeah, on how you review it. Remember there's different tests the Supreme Court has?
Well, I remember there are tests. What they are, I don't remember. something that had to do with the packaging laws and this is their ability to comply with it or something like that.
Well, there's different levels. There's strict scrutiny, which is the highest one. You remember, if you remember right. That one.
Yeah, and then I remember also, those words.
There's rational basis. And this rational basis test is the one that was used in this case for the Commerce Clause. And the rational basis test says is whether or not a government's actions are rationally related to a legitimate government interest. So,
well, there's nothing rational about the way Wisconsin feels about their butter.
Well, people in Wisconsin that's America's dairy land, and they are very passionate about all things dairy, obviously. So if you want to have strict grading for butter that is sold in the state, and there's evidently it's supported by laws for people who are in the state because the legislature has enacted those laws as they were supposed to. It's not just like some sort of executive order. I mean, this is the will of the people, supposedly. And the grading is rationally related to having a legitimate government interest in having high quality butter being sold in the state, then it meets a rational basis review. Now, does that make sense to you and me? Probably not.
No.
But we're not as passionate about butter, evidently.
I can't believe it's not butter.
I was waiting for that to come up.
Parquet. Butter. So. Parquet.
That's going to do it for legal briefs. I just wanted to go over the Commerce Clause because we talked about that a lot, but it comes up a lot.
Yeah.
Did you even know about the Commerce Clause before we started doing this podcast?
I will say I had probably heard of it before, but not realized the extent to which it is entangled in most everything.
Yes, everything. Because that's really the federal government.
It's a catch-all.
Well, it's the federal
government. It's just like that ketchup. It's like that ketchup standing the other.
The other?
That flavor, yeah. Anything you want to get involved in, just put it under the Commerce Clause.
I can't believe it's not Commerce Clause. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is winning. I know that most of the time you think about winning as being a good thing. I mean, of course, unless it is Charlie Sheen talking about it, then it is just drug-fueled craziness. But winning, when it is applied to the wrong circumstances, can make for bad decisions and tragic results. I am referring to our police departments and their training. They are pretty much trained in a military manner that involves complete dominance, superior force, and basically winning. While there is talk of training and de-escalation, I think that is all it is, talk. Let's take a look at two recent examples, how being calm and making more rational decisions could bring about a better outcome. With the George Floyd murder, even if guilty, he passed a fake $20 bill. Maybe he didn't even know it, even if it was fake, as someone could have given it to him. But if the officers entered the situation with the thought, this is just a misdemeanor, so let's just sort it out, take a report, and move on. First of all, we are all supposedly innocent until proven guilty, and second of all, the prisons have enough customers. Why look to add more for such minor things? The police should have approached this with the amount of importance that the alleged crime was, not winning or dominating another human being into humiliation and submission. In other words, if the punishment should fit the crime, this starts right up front with the way people are treated when they are first confronted. Counterfeiting does not come with the death penalty. So I am not even taking into account the way the questions that arise from the video and why he was placed in the car and back out and was not really struggling but was thrown to the ground and his pleas for mercy ignored. I mean the attitude the police approach the situation from the start. Now let's look at another example. Rayshard Brooks was found asleep in his car at a Wendy's. He failed a field sobriety test. Okay, it is clear he drove there drunk, but he is out of his car
and is not a danger to anyone. He asked to just be let go and let him walk to his house, which is not too far away. Still not endangering anyone. But the police decide they must handcuff him and bring him in. When he decides to run instead of comply, they shoot him in the back. Does this punishment fit this crime? Is there a death penalty for DUI? Then why do the police feel they have to win and completely dominate the situation? What would have been the problem if they just let Rayshard run off and go home? They have his car and license, so they know who and where he is. He is not a danger to anyone as he runs home. They can go to his house the next day or just mail him a summons. There are lots of ways it could have been handled where he doesn't feel threatened and where a proper punishment can be issued that is in proportion to the crime, which is at least less than death. I have heard plenty of people say, well, if he didn't resist, he wouldn't have been shot. Again, I ask, what is the punishment for resisting arrest? Less than death, I am sure. And don't even try to tell me the police felt threatened by someone that is running away from them. That comes from feeling like you have to win every encounter and dominate those you encounter, guilty or not. I will admit that I have been guilty in the past of saying, I wouldn't resist when being arrested, so that wouldn't happen to me. But now I understand that line of thinking comes from white privilege. The examples of black men that complied and still ended up dead are far too many to ignore. Black men may feel they only have a 50-50 chance of surviving a police encounter anyway, no matter what they do. If I thought those were my odds, I might try to run too. George Floyd didn't really resist, and especially neither did Elijah McClain. But they are both just as dead. So don't offer up that if you just comply with the police, everything will be fine, because that is not always the case. It all comes down to winning. So I would insist that officers be trained in first assessing the worst-case scenario based on the purported crime and then do their best to not administer more justice than the crime involved. And maybe try to remember that we are supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. If that is your thought going into a situation, instead of winning, maybe it will make for better outcomes. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.